The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
For a few years in the ISO, who's it kind of a new theory to, new-ish? So I dive in with a lot of theory and terminology here. So if there's stuff that you don't, that doesn't click or doesn't make sense, please let's get that right out first thing in the discussion. Like if there's term, I try to, you know, unpack terms and define them along the way, but it's very dense. And so just if there's stuff that doesn't quite make sense, I'll try to draw out the take home messages, but let's get that out on the floor in the discussion as well as soon as we open it up. For the working class, our labor defines us. For better or for worse, your job, your wage, your salary, how much money you have, how much money you make, or the potential you have to make, determines where you live, whether you have health care, or what kind of health care you have, whether you have health care or not, what shape your body is in, if you've done decades of manual labor, where your kids go to school, what your level of education might be, what level of education your parents might have had. We work all our lives. We want our work that we want the work that we do to have meaning, but so often it does not. Paulo Freire, a Brazilian educator and author of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, coined a phrase that I really like. He coined the phrase ontological vocation. And that's kind of a mouthful. Ontological just means being, and vocation just means the work or the work that we do, the labor that you do. And the idea is that your work is also your being. It's the merging of our work with meaning, and it's a goal based on the reordering of society. It is not it's not possible under capitalism, and it's really the opposite of alienated labor. Even if we like our jobs, we rarely say another day, another step towards my ontological vocation. So Marx took a different approach about work under capitalism. But again, Paulo Freire wasn't saying this is what work is like today. He's saying this is what work could be in a free society. Marx said in Wages of Labor, he described work and the working class this way. Political economy regards the proletarian like a horse. He must receive enough to enable him to work. Does not consider him during the time when he is not at work a human being. And that's pretty cold, but that's pretty accurate. Labor under capitalism is exploited, meaning we get paid less than the value of our work. Labor in our lives is shaped by oppression. And labor under capitalism is alienated, meaning we have no control over our labor or of the products of our labor. In the German ideology, Marx says, men must be in a position to live in order to make history. But life involves, before everything else, eating and drinking, clothing, and various other needs. The first historical act is thus the production of the means to satisfy these needs, the production of material life itself. And indeed, this is a historical act, a fundamental condition of all history, which today, as thousands of years ago, must daily and hourly be fulfilled merely in order to sustain life. So what does that mean? Before anything else can be done, and most notably before people can make history, engage in the world, be political, do the things that we're doing, before you can work, before you can create profit, earn wages, we must make, sustain, and reproduce life. It's the first historic act. And I think, though, that it's fair to say that while Marx might have identified that, it's an underdeveloped theory, especially when compared to some of his other theories. Social reproduction theory, Social reproduction theory attempts to fill out some of the areas that Marx did not fully develop. Anyone who has read, tried to read, listened to a talk on, read an article, or asked a question about capital, or any of Marx's other economic writings, you have some idea that Marx breaks down the production process into minute detail. Where does profit come from? What is a commodity? What is value? What sets wages? The sphere of production is very well documented. It's very well explored. Its characteristics are theorized. Its trends, components, and changes over time have all been discussed by Marx and many other economists and socialists and theorists for many, many years. But the reproduction of labor power is what Marx calls the first act. In order for production to happen, there need to be people to do the work. That is a working class, both as a class, but also as individuals. You literally need people. But so how does reproduction work, and what is its political economy? What does it take to create and sustain a constantly reproducing system? that's cheap, if possible, if not out-and-out free for the capitalists to be able to use year in and year out. One of the most significant contributions to this debate is social reproduction theory. Social reproduction theory takes the Marxist framework and extends it into areas that Marx did not. It embodies a critique of Marx's friend and collaborator, Friedrich Engels, specifically his attempt to develop an origin story of women's oppression and a tendency towards economic determinism. Those are some of the critiques that social reproduction theory makes of Engels. But I want to say two quick things in defense of Engels about what he got right before we move on. The first is that Engels rightly roots women's oppression in a historical, social, and material process. The form of the family, the separation of the public from the private sphere, and the stripping away of women's economic independence are key contributors to women's oppression, and these are central to Engels' argument. And the second, flowing from that, is the more obvious point. Women's oppression is a social construct. It flows out of social conditions, and it takes shape to meet certain needs. But what can be socially constructed can be socially deconstructed. That is, women's oppression can be fought, and a society that doesn't rely on women's oppression can be fought for and can be built. Marxism is sometimes critiqued for being overly focused on the sphere of production, that is the formal economy, wage work, making stuff for exchange and profit, how commodities are bought, sold, and moved around. There's not a very friendly caricature of Marxism sometimes, that all we care about is class, and all we care about is point of production, struggles, strikes, etc., workplace struggles. What social reproduction theory says is, yes, production is half of the puzzle of capitalism, but there is another half. There's the fact that in order for any of the activity in the productive sphere to happen, there has to be activity in the sphere of reproduction, and that is where labor power is produced and reproduced. One of the unique aspects of capitalism in a Marxist framework is that capitalism creates a class of workers that's the source of all its profit, but also plays the potential role of its undoing, the working class. But then how is the working class tended to and how is it reproduced? Marx said at the beginning I quoted, he says that it's the first act. The maintaining of the working class is the first act. But then he says about how this is done. He says the maintenance and reproduction of the working class remains a necessary condition for the reproduction of the working class itself. But the capitalist may safely leave this to the worker's drive to self-propagation. But really, the capitalist does not leave this merely to the worker's drive for self-propagation. I think you could argue that the family, reproductive rights, child rearing are some of the most regulated and institutionalized parts of the working class, of working class lives. So maybe Marx was being snarky or just emphasizing the capitalists actually don't care about the quality of working class life. Remember the other quote, the proletariat is a horse. And what he does when he's not working is of no concern to the capitalist. What we do know is that Marx did not develop a political economy of the reproduction of labor power or of domestic unpaid labor. In a Socialist Worker article from about 2 years ago, Tithi Bhattacharya comments on this phenomenon. She says, Marx is frustratingly silent on the rest of the story. If labor power produces value, how is labor power itself produced? Surely workers do not spring from the ground to arrive at the marketplace fresh and ready to sell their labor power to the capitalist. So the process by which this happens is the reproduction of labor power, which can be summed up as the maintenance and reproduction of the working class. This is obstructing me a little bit. And I'm just going to distinguish just a little bit right here between social reproduction theory broadly and the reproduction of labor power. Social reproduction as a term has grown to mean a bunch of different things. It can mean a broad range of processes. Marx used the term in Capital to mean the reproduction of the whole of capitalism, including both labor and capital. But it can also mean, the way it's used in a lot of literature today, is it's the study of domestic labor, caring labor, women's work. It means something, reproductive labor, it means something slightly different. And I think those are all valid uses of the term. Right now, I'm talking specifically about the reproduction of labor power with a slightly narrower definition, and this is based directly from the way Marx talks about it in Capital. So the reproduction of labor power is the maintenance of the worker themselves, the maintenance of the non-laboring members of the family, children, elderly family members on disability, or the unemployed. And finally, the replacement of one generation of workers with the next. It's a process almost, though not entirely, the responsibility of the working class itself, and is most often carried out in some form of the family. So in order for capitalism to function, it needs workers, and so there needs to be a way to regularly and consistently replenish the supply of workers, and really, it's best if workers would just take care of that themselves at no cost to the capitalists in some form of the family. Author Evelyn Nakano Glenn, who's done a lot of great writing on unpaid domestic labor, as well as the kind of the political economy of caring labor, she starts to answer this question when she describes the tasks covered by reproductive labor. So here's her list. The purchasing of household goods, preparing and serving food, laundering and repairing clothing, maintaining furnishings and appliances, socializing children, providing care and emotional support for adults, and maintaining kin and community ties. As Sharon Smith says in an International Socialist Review article, she says, all working class families with children, even single parent families or same-sex parents with children, perform the same essential function of reproducing labor power for capital. So no matter the form of the family, its role is to reproduce labor power. The form of the family can actually is a lot more flexible and a lot more varied than the stereotype of the nuclear family, as we all know. So as long as the function remains the same of reproducing labor for capital. So to look at the list again that I read, the functions of reproductive labor, you can almost see how you could develop a political economy of buying and preparing food, maintaining appliances. But the question becomes much more complex when you consider how do we develop a political economy of emotional support or of community and kin ties. And the interactions between and the parameters of the reproductive and productive spheres are not static. There are elements of the reproduction of labor power that have moved outside of the family unit. I would describe that as paid social reproduction, but I would argue that this has happened either as a result of struggle, or because it benefits the state, or because there's a profit to be made, or some combination of all of those things. In fact, I would narrow it down to reproduction of labor power is done in the household, it's subsidized and regulated by the state, so like public schools, or it's commodified, fast food, or all the things that used to be made in the household that are now purchased on the private market. So what does that mean? For generations in the United States, much more was actually done in the home, making and mending your clothes, cooking from scratch, schooling children. The growth of the public school system is an institution that was a demand of the working class, but it's also a need of capital. Child labor laws were enacted to protect kids from industrial injury and death, but that coincided and was directly related to the growth of the public schooling system. Widespread schooling benefits families by relieving them of the burden of having to educate the children themselves because the parents are working, but it also functions to prepare children to grow into adults, ready to play their role as members of the working class. Outside of the home, public schools are a function of the state. But these types of institutions are not just the result of a need of the ruling class, but also a result of struggle. And this is one of my favorite quotes, so if you've heard me talk about socialist reproduction before, you've heard this quote. The socialist feminist Joanna Brenner talks about this dynamic between, I'll just read the quote. One of the most important shifts in the organization of social reproduction in capitalist societies over the past century has been the emergence of the welfare state. The expansion of public or government responsibility for education, healthcare, and child rearing, as well as increased and often oppressive state regulation of families, especially those in the vulnerable parts of the working class, e.g. immigrants, oppressed racial ethnic groups, the poor, and single mothers. Although it's tempting to understand these developments as state managers acting in the long-term interests of capital, stepping in to guarantee the reproduction of the labor force while the capitalist employers will not, we might instead follow Marx's lead in focusing our attention on the self-organization of the working class. The extent and form of government expansion into social reproduction is the outcome of reform struggles in which middle class and working class men and women, not only capitalist managers and capitalist employers, played important roles. So when the elements of the reproduction of labor power move out of the home into the paid public sphere, they're still shaped by the fact that in the home, the work is done for free. And this point is important. If it's done for free in the home, it's not going to be well paid in the marketplace. This single fact shapes women's labor and really shapes all of what's considered women's work, whether or not it's done by women. It shapes its labor paid and unpaid and is central to women's oppression. While it's hard to say where the first instances of institutionalized women's oppression emerge, it's more than fair to say that class society, and especially capitalism, rely on, perpetuate, and naturalize women's oppression, and rely massively on the nuclear family to organize and carry out the reproduction of labor power. The work we call domestic labor is both waged and unwaged. Inside and outside of the home, its function stays consistent, but the form is actually quite fluid. Social reproduction looks different in different cultures and societies. Race interacts with social reproduction, and the gendered division of labor is often racialized. We look at how borders, race, and immigration all shape productive labor, and we should also look at how borders, race, and immigration also shape reproductive labor. Social reproduction theory has filled out Marxism in a way that I didn't even realize was necessary until recently. And I think Lise Vogel's book, which is in the Haymarket Room, her book, Marxism and the Oppression of Women, deserves a ton of credit for that. I just wish I'd read it sooner. And I don't believe it does everything it needs to do, and I think that developing an intersectional approach to social reproduction theory will actually deepen the theory and will make it even more relevant and indispensable. Excuse me. Evelyn Nakano-Glenn, the author I quoted earlier, explores the ways in which women's experience of domestic labor, and therefore of social reproduction, differs from that of women of color, and how many of the jobs which constitute paid reproductive labor are also done by women of color. A clarifying example of this is a statistic that she cites. Until the First World War, 90% of non-agriculturally employed black women in the South were employed as domestics. Even at the national level, servants and laundresses accounted for close to half of non-agriculturally employed black women in 1930. So that's worth considering for a moment, because in the households in which black women were employed, the white women who employed them didn't necessarily also work outside of the home. So within the household, there was a racial division of labor within that household's social reproduction, split between the white employer and the black employee, both women. This exemplifies the racial division of labor, but also provides a different example of how reproductive labor isn't only done inside the family for no wage. But unlike the example of public education, which socializes the labor and brings it into the public sphere where it can become a focal point for struggle, privately hiring domestic workers maintains the gender lines of reproduction. The work in the home is still done by women, but it also racializes the labor, all while keeping the work situated in the site of the home. So the ideology of the family is important, but it's secondary to the economic role that privatized reproduction plays, but it's a very close second. The ideology that says the nuclear family is the end-all be-all is the ideology that says that men are the protectors and women are nurturers. It says that single mothers and gay marriage are bad. It naturalizes women's economic and social oppression, justifies second-class status, and reinforces gender roles. That puts all members of the family in the impossible position of trying to meet all the physical, emotional, and social needs of the family. The ideal of the nuclear family sets the terms, even if the reality of that family is not so common. So the ideology is far more common than the reality. Single family households, same-sex families, extended family units, there are all plenty of variations of the form of the family. All of these work for capitalism as long as the economic role remains unchanged, privatized and unpaid domestic labor happens there. But what happens when the reproduction of labor power is disrupted? from job loss, homelessness, to wars which displace entire populations, to climate catastrophes creating waves of fleeing refugees, the reproduction of labor power faces ongoing challenges to its stability. The entire plot of The Handmaid's Tale is based on a complete societal reordering due to a disruption of the reproduction of labor power, namely a severe decline in fertility rates. Sylvia Federici, an author who I would recommend reading, she's great. She talks a lot about social reproduction and feminism and the oppression of women. She calls this a crisis of reproduction. And I would argue that it's one of the many crises that capitalism is prone to. The situation that many families are in is precarious, under attack, stressed out, and stretched thin. It's no wonder that the family is both a source of comfort and of stress for many working people. The ideal of the nuclear family hangs over us, but is always elusive. Women are never the perfect, beautiful mothers, and working class earnings have been consistently declining, while costs are rising, making middle class dreams unattainable, the always elusive American dream. The tension between this image and the reality, and the often brutal and inhumane reality that people face is the tension that characterizes working class families everywhere. It's the precipice that many families are forced to survive on. Capitalism pushes the family to the edge, but then relies on women's unpaid labor to keep us from completely falling over. In some cases, women's reproductive labor, carrying a baby, nursing, caring for children, takes them out of the productive sphere permanently or for periods of time. In other cases, women work full-time in the productive sphere while carrying a second shift of reproductive labor at home. Women are socialized into fields that pay less and are discouraged from asking for raises. And what does it mean that social reproduction is regulated? Back to Engels, this should give us an idea of why he was so right to link the rise of the family to the rise of the state. His book is called The Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State, and he links those as an integrated process. Some examples of the regulation are laws against gay marriage, interracial marriage, interracial or same-sex adoption, laws restricting what families on food stamps are allowed to buy, child labor laws that brought kids out of the factories into schools, all the way to rules about what kinds of food kids are allowed to bring for lunch in the public school. Note that there's a particularly harsh edge to some of these regulations, as they regulate the poor far more strictly than they regulate anyone else. And attacks on people in the realm of social reproduction is directly related to attacks in the productive sphere. Busting a union, outsourcing your job, downsizing, forcing wage cuts and furloughs, all of these are attacks on us as wage earners, both under the umbrella of the market economy. But the attacks don't stop there, and really they didn't start there. My point is the ruling class attacks on the working class don't unfold as attacks on the workplace. They only in the workplace. They also manifest as attacks on our schools, neighborhoods, families, and our health. Given this, the distinction between what is productive and what is reproductive means little when it comes to the attacks. We don't always experience our lives by the strict laws that govern capital. At the end of the 60s, a small group of feminists attempted to develop a Marxist analysis to explore the economic framework of unpaid women's work in the home. And they launched what they call the domestic labor debate. This is a very interesting debate. It's a little dense, theoretically, in my opinion. So maybe if people have questions about it or want to debate it, it's a debate, like I said, so it's pretty interesting. I'm just talking so I can drink some water. Women's work, quote unquote, housework, caring labor, child care, dominated women's experience, shaped their labor and their economic experiences, yet was either unexplored by the left or understood as part of a dual system. That is, that there's patriarchy and there's capitalism, and they're sort of two parallel systems. In an article from 1999, Lise Vogel reflects on the debate, and this is what she says. The domestic labor literature identified family households as sites of production. Reconceptualized as domestic labor, housework and child care could then be analyzed as labor processes. From this beginning came a series of questions. If domestic labor is a labor process, then what is its product? People, commodities, labor power? Does the product have value? If so, how is that value determined? How and by what or whom is the product consumed? What are the circumstances, conditions, and constraints of domestic labor? What is domestic labor's relationship to the reproduction of labor power? To overall social reproduction? to capitalist accumulation. Could a mode of reproduction of people be posited comparable to but separate from the mode of production? Could answers to these questions explain the origins of women's oppression? That's a lot of questions. That's a lot. It's like it's pretty dense debate, but it's very interesting. So she goes on to develop to explain the development of the debate. She says two general positions emerged. One claimed that the product of domestic labor is the commodity labor power, bearing both use value and exchange value. This could be taken to imply that domestic labor is productive of surplus value, and that those who do domestic labor, women, are exploited. That is, not just oppressed in the home, but actually economically exploited.
Could you just reread that one? That
yep.
Last sentence?
Absolutely.
Sorry.
No, not a problem. That's better than saying, can you reread that sentence from 20 minutes ago?
First position, right?
I'll just start from the beginning. Two general positions emerged. One claimed that the product of domestic labor is the commodity labor power, bearing both use value and exchange value. This could be taken to imply that domestic labor is productive of surplus value and that those who do domestic labor, women, are exploited, so not just oppressed, but exploited. In this way, sex contradictions acquire a clear material basis, and housewives occupy the same strategic position in the class struggle as factory workers. So that's one position. The second position, and this is the one that I would be more inclined to agree with, maintain that domestic labor produces only use values for direct consumption by household members, including the worker, and thereby contributes to the overall maintenance and renewal of the working class. Neither productive nor unproductive, domestic labor had to be theorized as something else, an undertaking few attempted. So that's her kind of reflecting on the debate at the time. So some other feminist theorists, Stella James and Maria Rosa Della Costa, who founded the Wages for Housework campaign, they take this position and they explain it this way. And they sort of fall into that first position camp that women are exploited and oppressed in the home, whereas Lise Vogel is saying women's labor is oppressed, but exploitation isn't happening in the family unit. What we mean precisely, and this is from the Wages for Housework campaign, what we mean precisely is that housework as work is productive in the Marxian sense, that is producing surplus value, that is producing profit. We speak immediately after about the productivity of the entire female role. It is often asserted that within the definition of wage labor, women in domestic labor are not productive. In fact, precisely the opposite is true if one thinks about the enormous quantity of social services which capitalist organization transforms into privatized activity, putting them on the back of housewives. Domestic labor is not essentially feminine work. A woman doesn't fulfill herself more or get less exhausted than a man from washing and cleaning. These are social services in as much as they serve the reproduction of labor power. That's very important. I totally agree with that. I don't necessarily agree with some of the other stuff, but that's really important, I think, what they're saying there. And capital, precisely by instituting its family structure, has liberated the man from these functions so that he is completely free for direct exploitation, so that he is free to earn enough for a woman to reproduce him as labor power. So that's a little bit... it's a little complicated. It took me a few readings to really try to parse out what she's saying there. So feel free to ask questions or ask me to repeat things. So this is sort of my take on this. In this piece, they're asserting that housework is productive. But I would argue they conflate the reproduction of labor power with productive labor. They also, from my reading of this passage, get pulled into the moral gray area of the word productive. In a Marxist sense, productive means value producing. And Vogel and other Marxist feminists have argued that the indispensability of domestic labor for the functioning of capital does not make it productive in that specific, narrow Marxist sense. So, invaluable, but doesn't meet that strict definition of productive. But what Lise Vogel said earlier is that she says it's not productive, nor is it non-productive. It's a sort of some this other thing. And she doesn't tell us what this other thing is exactly, so we get to figure that out. But the critique is that they're sort of conflating productive with meaning very, very important and indispensable. And it is a social service. So Angela Davis in Women, Race, and Class, which was actually published the same year that Lise Vogel's book was published, which I think is very interesting, 1983, of these two like amazing feminist theorists, activists trying to figure out women's oppression from both a Marxist and a historic framework. So, but in Women, Race, and Class, Angela Davis critiques the wages for housework framework. In addition to disputing the notion that domestic labor produces surplus value, she points to, I think correctly, that the wages for housework looks to an individual household by household solution rather than a collective solution to the repetitive nature of housework. It also assumes a heteronuclear family, and it pits the working class man against the working class woman and invites in, not intentionally, but I would argue it invites in, the government policing and regulation of families further. Like I mentioned, we already have a lot of that. Every house and apartment on the block does the exact same chores individually and privately, collectivizing the work, which Angela Davis is arguing for, and therefore the struggle. And she's arguing that it should become the responsibility, like public education is the responsibility of the state, that this, as it is a social service, should be taken up as a responsibility of the state. She's arguing for it on that level. And she's saying that she's saying that we need to collectivize the work, and then therefore the struggle will become more collectivized, great. And that would be a much more effective way to deal with not just the drudgery, but the isolation and time-consuming nature of housework. So I mentioned to Emily earlier that new parents often come to this talk. And I see that there are new parents in the audience, and it is very alienating to be that parent doing the work. You feel alone in your home, you're isolated, and yet it's. I mean, you could think of rearing your child as a social service, maybe you don't think of it that way, but it's an experience that millions of people go through every day, the work, the struggle. Wouldn't it be so much better if we collectivized that work and that struggle? Wouldn't that free us up, you know, from having to do more stuff, but also wouldn't it collectivize us and humanize the work just a little bit more? I find this to be a very, very interesting debate. I really think it's fascinating and fun to think through. It was pretty short-lived, unfortunately. Lise Vogel talks about how the debate didn't survive the 70s, and in the 1999 essay that I mentioned earlier, she posits whether there's space to reopen some of these questions. I think there is, and I do think, like I mentioned earlier, having a slightly broader understanding with an intersectional approach to and an international approach to the reproduction of labor power would be good. And especially in light of the International Women's Strike, which was put on the table just this last Women's Day, International Women's Day. I'll get to that in a couple minutes. We're on the home stretch of the talk. While many of the same laws of capitalism factor in reproduction, it's also the case that the reproductive sphere is shaped by some more unquantifiable factors, such as care and love. The production of goods and services, as well as the production of life, are integrated into one process and governed by the same trends, tendencies, and forces, but not always exactly the same laws. Social reproduction theory, or this understanding of the reproduction of labor power, integrates the different facets of our lives, brings the unpaid, poorly paid, and otherwise taken for granted work of the reproduction of labor power to a level on par with production. That puts fights in the sphere of reproduction central to uniting the working class and rebuilding a working class fight back against neoliberalism and its myriad attacks on us. If the reproductive sphere is vital to capitalism, how do we struggle in that area in a way that both improves conditions for people working in those areas as well as poses the same kind of threat to capitalism that a profit-stopping strike can? I mentioned the International Women's Strike, but I want to first talk about its predecessor. In 1970, the National Organization for Women and other women's rights groups organized a National Women's Strike for Equality. Slogans included, "Don't iron while the strike is hot." I know, that's awesome. "Hard hats for soft broads," "I am not a Barbie doll," "Storks fly, why can't mothers?" The New York City rally was at 5 p.m. to accommodate women who could not miss work, and the demands included free abortion on demand and access to subsidized childcare. Importantly, many of the demands also took up issues of unequal pay and access to jobs in the workforce. But rather than being a strike of one workforce or one industry, it was a collective show of force against women's oppression in whatever form it was experienced. So fast forward a lot to January 21st of this year, to the Women's March. While the Women's March was centered around the Trump inauguration, it drew attention to the reality that the Trump election is a huge affront to women's rights, to the LGBTQ community, and to really all oppressed people everywhere. It opened a lot of questions, and it hasn't answered them all yet. Fast forward again to this spring. Declaring the need for a feminism for the 99%, which is a slogan that I really like, a group of feminists from several countries made a call for a coordinated international women's strike on March 8th, which is International Working Women's Day. The Nation wrote an article about the strike, and they said, "The International Women's Strike aims to target injustices that long precede the Trump administration. The platform defines the day as organized by and for women who have been marginalized and silenced by decades of neoliberalism directed towards working women, women of color, Native women, disabled women, immigrant women, Muslim women, lesbian, queer, and trans women." The call for March 8th listed a number of ways people could support, from boycotting sexist companies to having a strike or job action in your workplace to wearing red in solidarity. The call was taken up in an uneven manner in the United States, but it was an important step in a couple of ways. International Women's Day is actually a major day of action in other parts of the world, like Europe, Asia, and Latin America, and this call stood consciously in solidarity with international actions. And I personally, for the US, I like the idea of putting striking on the map. It was called, people could interpret it and act however they could on that day, but it was, but it put striking back on the map, even if it wasn't possible for everybody individually. And importantly, the connections between struggles that the organizers made and the slogans they raised indicated a step forward. Kianga Yamada Taylor was one of the people on the original call for the International Women's Strike and bringing International Women's Day back on the agenda. She did an interview with Jacobin, and this is her quote. It's a little long. "But there's another area of a women's strike that is intended to call, but there's another history of a women's strike that is intended to call attention to the unpaid and often overlooked contributions of women's labor, what some refer to as social reproduction. In some ways, that's the point. Women's work, in the home especially, but in other ways that some work has been feminized, is devalued or differently valued. The removal of that labor draws attention to the important and often unpaid, or at least undervalued and underpaid, role of women in the functioning of society. This is especially true for Black women, Latinas, and women from immigrant communities. Black women are paid 63 cents for every dollar made by a white man. Undocumented women working in agriculture and domestic work not only toil for low wages, but are under the constant threat of physical and sexual violence because of the absence of any workplace or civil protections on account of their immigration status." Moving forward from March 8th, struggles have moved up and down. There hasn't been yet another outpouring like the Women's March or the airport protests after Trump announced his travel ban, but the seeds have been planted, and I believe that important connections are being made that will be valuable when struggle does again emerge. And even though it's only at the beginning, part of the call is to bring attention to the amount of unpaid labor disproportionately on the backs of women, and especially women of color, that capitalism relies on to function. I'm not sure how struggles in the sphere of reproduction will continue to roll out, but I do think that recognizing the struggles in the reproductive sphere as complementary to the struggles in the productive sphere, as opposed to subordinated to or secondary to, is crucial. In fact, reproduction is a necessary precondition for production, and we can struggle in both of those areas. The value of understanding the balance and interconnectedness of the productive and reproductive spheres of capitalism is that they show up in the interconnectedness of our lives. We are public and private. We are babies, we are aged, we work, we're unemployed. We are producers, we're consumers, we're free, and we are incarcerated. The working class is all of these things at once, and the quality that unites us is solidarity and struggle. The great poet and activist Audre Lorde summed it up this way. She said, "There's no such thing as a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives."
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.